Hello, folks. This is Vinay, the host of the Shiny Happy People podcast. Welcome, 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 listeners, and welcome back to our regular listeners. Today, we have an interview segment, and it's with a person in an area that I've always been passionate about. That's something that I started my consulting career in this, and we're going to sort of dig deep and go deeper into the conversation of what's happening in this field. And I'm being a bit mysterious because I'll only talk about the field once I introduce our guest. Okay, so our guest today is Maria Morokian. She's the president of MSM Consulting. For the last 20 years, she's been a consultant, a coach, a facilitator. She does a lot of work around diversity, equity, inclusion. Her work's been featured in Forbes, TD Magazine. She's also an author. She's a TEDx speaker. She's worked with the government in the US and federal agencies. And she is also a podcast host. She has a very popular DEI podcast called Culture Stew. And she's been in this field. She's seen it evolve over the last couple of decades. It was an interesting conversation because we got a bit deep and at sometimes heavy into some of the latest things that are happening and how and why things are changing and how and why things are not changing enough. So stay tuned and you're going to hear the conversation between Maria and I right after this break. Okay, folks. So finally, the moment's here. We've got Maria with us. Maria, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I am delighted.
So I did an intro of you just before we start this conversation. So our listeners know a little bit about your background, the work that you do. What I'm curious to hear is, who is Maria? What's the genesis of Maria? Where does she come from? What's the background? Let's start from the basics.
Oh, I love that. The genesis of Maria. I am, as you can probably tell from my accent, American from the United States. I was born and grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and lived a very sort of prototypical Midwestern, white, Christian, middle-class upbringing in many ways. And yet I also was exposed to and lived in a multicultural environment. So my family is immigrant, refugee family, actually. My father's family fled from Istanbul, Turkey, in the 1920s during the Armenian genocide. And right. At the time, they were not able to join the rest of their family and community who had already emigrated to the US because the United States had closed its borders to non-Western European immigrants. So my family went to Cuba, and my father actually was born and grew up in Cuba. Oh, and so wow. He had a very interesting sort of bicultural, bilingual upbringing where he was Armenian at home and Cuban in the streets with his friends. And then as a young man, he and his family came to the United States, not knowing the language, not knowing the culture, and having to start all over again. So he, I think, always brought that that understanding that we are often more than one thing, and also the curiosity and the adaptability that many immigrants and refugees have when they have been uprooted many times in their lives. And my mother grew up in a tiny little village, a farming community of 300 people in Michigan, where for generations, everybody spoke Polish. And so her first language and her culture were Polish, even though she was American. So it was a very interesting upbringing and childhood for me. But one of the things that was very deeply embedded in me was as I mentioned, this idea of curiosity, of a willingness to always be a learner and to explore cultural identity and understand people's lived experiences beyond what we can see. And I think that's really been a core part of my personal life and my professional life. I really centered that in my studies when I was going to school, as well as, really what has drawn me to the career that I have, focusing on the human aspects of organizations and behavior.
So it's interesting, your background in multicultural stuff, and is that what drove you to look at the intercultural work that you started doing early on in your career? Or
definitely, that was something that was so prevalent for me, and I think the sense of responsibility that I've always had to help build bridges and connections across cultural identities, to help people be able to communicate and see the value of exploring our differences, and also just for myself to always be able to learn and grow and adapt to different situations. Definitely my own cultural upbringing, as well as the recognition of how important it is for us to establish connections and appreciate our identity differences rather than see them as a threat.
Right. And you must have, you definitely seen the whole field of intercultural and diversity evolve in the last recent past, right? I mean, it's just been crazy how it's finally come front and center for all the wrong reasons, in my opinion. But at least people are talking about it.
Yes, it's been, I think we practitioners see it as a blessing, and I won't say a curse, but, the intercultural work, diversity, equity, and inclusion have been present and around for decades. And yet, we are at a moment in time, especially in the last 3 years, certainly in the United States, but I think globally, where a number of different political, cultural, economic forces have really pushed this notion of exploring identity differences and prioritizing equity and sort of human rights to the center of our work. So it's exciting. There's a little bit, I think, for many of us of frustration, like you're just now understanding why this is important. So there's I think sometimes we fall prey to a little bit of impatience. And at the same time, I welcome the fact that that people are here now and at a place where they are willing to and ready to have these conversations.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think the big difference today is the conversation's a lot deeper than it used to be. I mean, I've been in the intercultural space for about 20, 25 years, being an interculturalist myself, right? Lived and grew up in different parts of the world. But a lot of the intercultural work early on was really transactional, if you know what I mean. It's really about how do we help this group work more effectively with that group, or do business across geographic boundaries, or travel and be effective when you're trying to set up an office someplace. It was a little more business driven, and today it's gone at a more personal level and say, how can I be more sensitive to the other group? How can I be more inclusive of our differences and accepting? I don't know if you've seen that. And
yes, Vinay, I could not agree more. I think that focus on transformational versus transactional is really powerful. And also it's just so important for at the individual level for people to really grow and develop their capacity to make connections, because I can give you a list of do's and don'ts for this country or that culture, but that's not going to really serve you, especially when you find yourself in complex situations. And also to your point, and this is where I think that the intercultural competence work and DEI work intersect so nicely, is that in any given societal culture, there are so many dimensions and microcultures that exist. And so not everybody comes from the same set of norms or beliefs or behaviors. And so I think we're starting to see, which is really exciting to me, an acknowledgement and an exploration of this idea of interculturalism through the lens of the dominant cultures and the non-dominant cultures, because the experiences and the way that we navigate those experiences can sometimes be very different.
Yeah, no, absolutely agree with you. And I love what you just talked about, the microcultures and the subcultures. And you don't even have to leave a geographic location to discover a whole plethora of cultures living around you if you just kept your eyes and ears and senses open, right? Whether it's from a food perspective or beliefs and values, there's so many deeper levels of it. So from your perspective, what's been an interesting trigger point? What is something in the last 10 years that you've seen your practice in this evolve?
That's a great question. I think in terms of the evolution of my work and my practice, one thing that I have really taken the time to center my work around is that in order to institute and sustain meaningful change, that is going to be long-term, right? In reference to organizational cultures, we can't just come in and do training. And that's very difficult for me to say as somebody who is a trainer and training specialist, but training does not fix everything.
And it's the tick in the box, right? I mean, it's a start, but it can't be the, it's a means to the end, but it can't be the end.
Yes. And we often look at these complex challenges and oversimplify them, right? So for example, oftentimes I'll have clients come to me and say, okay, well, we realize that we don't have much racial diversity or gender diversity in our organization. So help us bring in more people who represent these differences. And they want a quick answer, right? Tell me who to reach out to recruit more people who are not currently represented in our organization. And it's an oversimplification, I think, of these more complex challenges. So I think in terms of the trigger point or the evolution of my work and where I see a lot of fellow practitioners really leaning in is helping organizations and leaders begin to bring a more complex approach to addressing these problems and recognizing that there are multiple touch points that have to be addressed sometimes simultaneously rather than, oh, if we just do these three things, we'll fix the problem, because it's not a technical problem, right? It's an adaptive challenge.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I always say the training is the Band-Aid, right? Yes. If you want to put a quick Band-Aid that people will remember for the next 48 hours, or the next upcoming meeting, and then they forget everything. But if you want to make institutionalize the change, it's so critical. The other interesting thing is, you know, I'm sure you remember the days where we used to just call it D&I, and then suddenly overnight, literally, it became DE&I. And we started adding another layer of the conversation, which just talked about, hey, it's not what you just said. It's not the majority culture talking about all the minority cultures or vice versa. It's also about bringing equity to the conversation. I don't know, what's your thoughts around it? It's not just DE&I, right? There's more beyond it as well.
Yes, we see a number of acronyms being added, and I welcome all of them, right? Whether it's the B for belonging, the J for justice, the A for accessibility. In my mind, the root of it is ensuring that we are creating systems that are encompassing, fair, and sensitive to the needs of everyone. Mm. And so however we determine that or label it, I think if we focus on that common vision, then we start to see progress. I've been really very pleasantly surprised, I guess I could say, that the equity piece has become such a focal point in the last few years, because I think increasingly leaders recognize that without looking at equity, without bringing that equity lens to this work, we're going to end up with more of the same that we've always had. And so it's appreciating identity differences, that's the D, bringing in more representation, creating environments that are inclusive and welcoming to all, but that can sometimes still end up being superficial. And, you know, maybe it's not a Band-Aid, but it's a larger bandage or a cast that we're putting on the systemic disease that we're fighting against. I think that equity lens is really important.
So agree with you 100%. The quality of the conversations got a lot better. The layering in the conversation by bringing in equity, we can talk about the unconscious biases that might ride. There's so many layers of it. But here's a question for you. While the conversations got better, how do we make the impact last? How do you make a lasting change? How can we make it progress beyond just a short time? What's your tips on that?
Great question. So I think it's going beyond conversation, first and foremost. The conversations have become deeper, and we need to ensure that there is collective ownership over the action. And one of the biggest challenges that I've seen that organizational leaders have sort of the trap that organizational leaders have fallen into is, okay, so we will delegate this to an outside consultant, or we'll delegate this to a HR, human resources, or we'll hire a chief diversity officer and delegate, right? It's always pushing it out rather than taking ownership. And so I think the first thing that is absolutely critical for these efforts to be sustainable is for people who are in the highest levels of power and status at our organizational levels, at our institutional levels, at the governmental levels, to take ownership over this change and to see themselves as actors rather than saying, well, this isn't me, it's somebody else who needs to do the work.
Right.
And I think it's also embedding diversity, equity, inclusion principles and practices across the organization so that it's not just relegated to human resources or to training and talent development or to the Office of Civil Rights or Equal Opportunity Protections, but rather wherever we sit in the organization, we also have a clear understanding of our role and responsibility for upholding these policies and practices and living this as a core value. And we have seen there is extensive research that's been done looking at those organizations that are really perceived as models when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And there are best practices on a global scale. And I think that's the sort of the foundational element is everybody, and in particular, people in leadership positions, board members, the folks who have the most influence to shift the organizational structure and culture, have that sense of responsibility.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. It definitely has to start from the top. My concern there is it becomes very easy to just make it a metrics thing, right? You know, what's our gender diversity on the board? What's our racial diversity on the board, right? How many people we have, and then we're done. We've ticked these boxes. And that is just so unfortunate, because what it's really got to translate to, and what I'm hearing you say, is it's got to translate into the micro behaviors. What kind of conversations are you going to have? How do you role model it? to the rest of the others. And that's where I, the first part, the metrics, that's great. And every once in a while, we see articles that say, even now, after so many years, as simple as the number of women CEOs or number of women leaders on boards or the pay parity or the lack of pay parity, and all of those numbers keep coming out to remind us that there's work to be done. But there's very few role models on the behaviors aspect of it. You know, who stands out for you is either an organization or someone that you say, look, wow, they're getting it right at all levels.
Yes. Oh, that's such a great question. I think that there are many organizations that are at various stages on the continuum. And I don't think any come to mind that 100% have got it, quote unquote, right. But I do see a shift in some of the organizations that we have partnered with, it, just in terms of the frequency with which diversity, equity, and inclusion are discussed, are brought into conversations that they haven't been a part of before. So, for example, one group that we've been partnering with for a number of years now is part of the animal welfare movement. So these are, you know, folks that are leaders in humane societies, animal shelters, as well as on the law enforcement side in terms of animal control. And historically, animal welfare has been very homogeneous in terms of representation. And it has catered to a very small section of communities, usually people in higher socioeconomic brackets who have, you know, and often, quite honestly, in the United States at least, are white. And so what we've seen over the last 3 years is not only have they done a lot of training, we did a broad-based assessment of the, you know, sort of the industry as a whole and the experiences and perspectives around diversity, equity, and inclusion. But just recently, I was at a conference that they that was centered on animal welfare, and almost every session at the conference had some sort of perspective around diversity, equity, and inclusion. So within just a couple of years, what I have seen is this is something that we don't even talk about. It's on the periphery, and we just collectively don't understand the importance. Why does this matter? We should be caring about the animals. Who cares about the humans too? We must be talking about the humans. We must be advocating for diversity, equity, and inclusion. And here's what it looks like in our organization or in our corner of the industry. And so the level of readiness and the level of increased comfort in having conversations about what that looks like for the industry has taken place in just a short amount of time. And although that might not necessarily be measurable, I do see it as a cultural shift, right, that people are experiencing and acknowledging.
Oh, that's a great, that's a really great example. And it's more than a start in the right direction, right? It's actually several jumps, I won't say leap, but several jumps ahead in the right direction.
You're listening to the Shiny Happy People podcast with Vinay Kumar. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. This podcast is sponsored by C2C OD, your organizational development consulting partner, bringing people and strategy together. Follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook using the handle at C2C OD, and get updates on our upcoming episodes.
What's your thought? I also think that the reason this whole conversation's just taken up in this is either organizations can do it from inside and then go out, but I that's, to me, I've found is a much slower process, and as you said, leader-centric, whether the leader wants to do it, But I think there's a new layer to this where societal conversations are moving at a much faster pace and are forcing organizations to have it, right? So if with everything in the US, particularly Black Lives Matter, all of that that happened, but even in other parts of the world, you're seeing it in Europe, for example, with migration, with increased immigration coming from certain parts of the world, or where I am in India, we have challenges on our borders with Bangladesh and other refugees coming in. So there's a bigger conversation that's happening that the society is having the conversation, and now companies are having to play catch up. What do you think? Yeah.
That is part of what makes this work, I think, so complex and not easy to always identify a single solution. Because to your point, Vinay, this is happening on a global scale. The increased mobility across borders that are often not happening because people necessarily choose to, but because of either economic, environmental, or political forces that are leading people to leave their homes, their countries, their cultures, because they are no longer safe in many instances. And so that increased mobility has led to much more mixing across societal cultures than I think we've seen at any other point really in our recent human history. And so absolutely that requires us to, regardless of where we live, to develop a new set of skills and competencies to be able to connect and build space and create societies and communities that work for everybody. And when we do so, what we have seen overwhelmingly, I think, is that more heterogeneous, multicultural communities, organizations, societies, there are immense benefits, right? Economically, culturally, and it's not necessarily always in our human nature to be accepting and to create that new way of seeing the world, or to acknowledge and accept other perspectives. And so I absolutely think that organizations are now, as you said, trying to play catch up. And in particular, because for the next generation, for employees who are joining the workforce or will be joining the workforce in the years to come, their experience has inherently, because of this more higher global mobility, been more multicultural.
Yeah.
There's a higher level of acceptance of even just broadly on a global scale, gender equity, across male and female, but also I think an increased recognition and acceptance of religious diversity, of sexual orientation diversity. Yeah. So organizations, I think, and their leaders who came up with and have been a part of and perpetuated these organizational systems that worked in the past are now finding themselves rushing to reshape the way that they work. And there are, I think, value misalignments. It's hard for us to change our patterns of behavior. Right?
No, you're absolutely correct. And the incoming workforce, and I don't want to put the millennials label or any other label on it, but the incoming workforce has a more aware expectation and are much more vocal about it than ever before. And if they're not happy, they'll put it out on social media and are very okay to say, this is the brand that I don't like, or this is the company that is not doing right by the community. And boom, there goes your marketing budget and everything else for a leader. The business case has never been stronger as well. But on the flip side, from a societal perspective, I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks, maybe a month or so ago, and he said to me, there's fatigue. And I said, well, fatigue on what? He said, there's DEI fatigue. I'm like, how can you have DEI fatigue? He said, just tired of talking about it all the time, right? And being bombarded with messages around it and having to be more aware and conscious of every subculture and community and where do we draw the line? And I just looked at him and said, well, it's still evolving. But is that fatigue real? What do you think?
Absolutely. And I would expand on that to say that many are feeling fatigue in different ways. So, for example, I often hear people coming from non-dominant, marginalized identity groups expressing fatigue from having to be the representatives of their identities and constantly share their experiences or feel as though they are responsible for not only educating people from the dominant identity groups, but also sometimes feeling like they are being expected to take the lead on all of these efforts. So I think there's fatigue in terms of the emotional labor that comes from being the person who has been on the receiving end of, to some extent, sometimes intergenerational trauma around that marginalization and societal oppression. And there's fatigue from people who are on the dominant identity side, who have been in positions of power and are now, to your point, feeling like we're being bombarded with all of these messages telling us that we are in the wrong, that the system that has, you know, felt very comfortable for us is wrong and we are responsible for dismantling it, but we don't necessarily have the skills or the knowledge to do that. And so I think, yes, absolutely, there's a general fatigue that comes with wrestling with these complex challenges because our human brains like to simplify the story and find the simpler solutions. And those solutions are not available to us. So absolutely, yeah. I think acknowledging the fatigue and giving people the space to have rest, that we can't always be bombarding one another with these messages, but can we equip people with the skills and the ability and the willingness to be able to not see this as a labor or a burden, but more so as this is an opportunity for us to build a better future together.
No, that's a great point. It's an opportunity for us to further the cause or further the conversation and make it more easier. It's unfortunately also an opportunity for people on the other side of the spectrum to take this fatigue and use it for political purposes or just to make it us versus them. And there's a lot of that happening, especially in your part of the world. And unfortunately, we see it in the news, and now there's, you know, anti-woke and, you know, all of that stuff, the new labels that's being thrown and bandied about, right? How are you handling that part? So there's always a counterforce to everything good we try to do.
Yeah, yes. And this is not new either, right? We could look throughout not only American history, but human history and find these backlashes to societal progress, to movements toward inclusion and equity. This often is the case. And so I think one for me and for many of my colleagues, it's just sometimes bringing that historical lens and reminding ourselves, this is sort of a natural part of the continuum toward change, that there will often be higher levels of resistance the more disruptive the change will be, even when that disruptive change is so necessary and so welcomed by many, it still is very challenging. And for me also, I often find myself, a lot of the work that I'm doing is trying to bring people together to engage in intergroup dialogue and to create space to acknowledge that not everyone is looking at this through the same lens. And so rather than shutting people down who disagree with us, can we create space where if I take some time to listen to your side and understand why you believe what you believe and what this means for you and what feels threatening to your way of seeing the world or living in it, then I understand you better. I may still vehemently disagree with your perspective and your ideology, but I can acknowledge the human who is having the very real and valid emotions that you are. And in doing so, I will tell you, not only is this, does this bear out in the research, but anecdotally, personally, I've seen it. When I do that, when I take the time to just really listen deeply and give some space and some compassion for people who have very different ideologies, they are more willing to do the same for me. Yeah. So I think that law of reciprocity, if we can manage our own emotional reactions to those who we perceive as them, we can often find common ground. And even where we can disagree without dehumanizing.
You know, it's so, so true. And that's the deep listening aspect. And I always, I try and practice this. Acknowledgement is so important, and acknowledgement does not mean agreement, right? Just acknowledging the other person's perspective is so, at least it makes them heard and they're more able to hear you in that conversation as well. And it's so, so true. But how do you stay out of the politicization conversations? How do you stay above that fray? It's so easy to get dragged down in the muck and join, obviously walk away from the shouting. But we're also not doing a great service by walking away from the shouting.
Exactly. You
know, but it's exhausting to stay in the shouting, in the noise.
Yes. And I wish that I could tell you that I handle all of those situations with grace and dignity. But
oh, Maria, I thought you were going to prescribe a special vitamin pill or something. No, there isn't one.
I wish if I invented that pill, I think that I would solve a lot of problems in the world. It is imperative for me to be selective with when and who and how I engage in those more confrontational or divisive conversations. I'm not always in a mental or emotional or even physical state to have a dialogue with somebody. Where it will be a healthy conversation for either one of us. And so I think recognizing and accepting that there are times where walking away is the best thing to do is important. And I often will take a moment, if I am choosing to walk away, to say, I'm not in a space to have this conversation with you right now. And I think it's important. Can we consider revisiting it at a time where both of us are in a state where we can really listen to each other? That's not always possible. But I think sometimes that is a really important acknowledgement to make. And also, I just have to recognize that I need rest in between these conversations. And so if I have found myself having to facilitate a number of divisive conversations or dialogues, then I really try to build in a day or two where I am unplugged and I can just focus on self-care.
To go back and center yourself, right? Yeah. So it's it comes back to, and for the lack of a better phrase, I want to say, sometimes you have to pick your battles. Which conversations do you want to make the greatest impact, or you can add the most value? I think it comes so critical.
As a consultant, as a facilitator, I often will preface my work with clients or with groups and say, it's very possible and probable that I am going to disappoint somebody in the way that I handle a certain situation in this process. And I welcome that feedback. And I also, I put that out there because part of this work is making minute by minute decisions about which direction to go in the conversation. And inevitably I'm going to choose a way that either in retrospect, I realize was not the wrong, was not the right choice or someone else in the room is going to feel like I didn't make the right choice for them. And so that's part of this work, is that we have to offer ourselves and one another some space to mess up and to learn and to try to make amends or make changes moving forward.
Right. And I'm assuming, because we've had an amazing conversation, I'm assuming you love what you do.
I love what I do. It's exhausting. And sometimes I think, why did I do this to myself? But but those moments of clarity, those moments where I see people connecting with compassion in ways that they never thought possible, those sustain me for years. And even just saying that makes me feel emotional, because it is, that is my life purpose.
Yeah, because it's, we're making that impact. When we do make it, it lasts for such a long time, and it's such a deep impact we make for people, right? So we sometimes never, actually, I'll say we often never ever see the result of it, but there's positive energy out there. And that's the way I look at it. So how do you go and center yourself? What's your secret space? Or maybe not so secret.
I have two young daughters who are 8 and 10 years old. And so most of my private time is spent just enjoying them. We play a lot together. We love, my daughters are very creative. And so there's a lot of music and dancing and acting that takes place. And I think just sort of being able to just be at play with them and witness them and learn from them is incredibly powerful and sustaining for me.
Yeah, no, I can absolutely imagine. What's your other centering, right? How do you keep yourself positive, happy? Kids will definitely do it. But is it movie, music? What's your downtime?
I mean, this might sound like other people's torture, but I love running. I always have. I've been a runner since I was young. And for me, it is, there's something not only physical, but also mental, emotional, spiritual. It's my time to be alone and with my thoughts, with my favorite audiobook, with my music that I'm listening to. But there's something very, for me, very calming and recentering about being able to just pick a direction and run. And so that is definitely something when I'm really feeling low, when I'm feeling exhausted, strangely enough, putting on my sneakers, my trainers, and going for a run, even just for 15, 20, 30 minutes, is a beautiful way for me to recenter.
Yeah, nothing like a runner's high.
Yes.
Right, yeah, brilliant. And I know you got in, you're a podcaster as well. Tell our listeners something about your podcast.
Yes, so my podcast is called Culture Stew. It's actually in its fourth season, going into our fifth season soon. And the impetus and sort of the name came from this notion that we are all multidimensional and we're sort of this mixture of a variety of different identity characteristics. And so we sort of all bring our own set of spices to our proverbial stews. And it sometimes is messy, but we each have our own flavor. And so the purpose of the podcast is really to bring on guests who represent these multiple dimensions of identity. Some are people who come from the diversity, equity, and inclusion world or intercultural profession, but others are people who are coming from very different walks of life. So authors, academics, business owners who bring a story as well as a call to action for how we can learn and grow and understand people in a new and exciting way.
Nice. It's also like you and I are having, it's just sometimes fun to be able to connect with people in who you've never met, right? So that's also brilliant. And so with being so busy, you also went and found time to go write a book in the midst of all of this. So I don't think you have a lot of downtime. I mean, I have a feeling when you're running, you're probably giving voice notes to yourself.
How did you know, Vinay? How did you know?
I kind of guess that you're going to use every minute that's possible. Tell us about the book.
So the book is Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for Trainers, Fostering DEI in the Workplace. And it was published by the Association for Talent Development. Yeah. And specifically for an audience of trainers and talent development professionals looking to embed diversity, equity, and inclusion into their work. But what's been really gratifying is that I've heard from people who have read the book who have no prior knowledge or formal experience in training and talent development, but they've found value in the book in terms of, here's how I, as an individual contributor in my organization, in my community, with my family, can begin to explore these issues of DEI and help to make progress. And so I think it's for trainers, but also for what we often refer to as the accidental trainers in any given time of our lives. Where might we be able to bring that DEI lens to others? And so that's been really gratifying to see the impact that the book is having on a broader scale.
So cool. I got to pick up that book because I'm active in ATD as well. And this morning I was doing a workshop and the conversation really went to cognitive diversity, which is the other piece. And we got into a very deep conversation with the group and which was not in the original agenda of conversation, but we went down that path. And and a lot of them at the end said, thank you for bringing this to the conversation we are having today, because it's just a reminder. And thank you for role modeling by inviting all our opinions. So I think as every trainer, facilitator, we have an opportunity to role model diversity, equity at so many levels, right?
So, absolutely.
So with that, it's been an awesome conversation, Maria. What's your secret ingredient for happiness?
My secret ingredient for happiness is, oh gosh, I think it's practicing gratitude and living with hope. Anytime I'm feeling really down, just taking a moment to think about, how am I contributing to the kind of worlds that I want to create for others, and in particular my own children? And that helps to remind me that there is, no matter what, there's always joy, there's always hope.
Yeah, it's so true. And it's all about leaving the world a better place for the next generation, especially better society, right? Brilliant, Maria. Really, really enjoyed this conversation going, but thank you so much for making time for this.
Thank you, Vinay.
Okay, folks. So, what did you think of this conversation with Maria? Drop us some feedback. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what stood out for you. Links to her podcast, her book, is in the show notes, so look it up. Should be some interesting listening there and reading, of course. And stay tuned for more guest episodes coming up soon, plus my colleague Dhruti, who does her resilience series, as well as a few other episodes that we may pop in every now and again. Keep that feedback coming, and thank you for listening. Over and out.